could you first tell me, Mr. George Burks, where and when you were born?
I was born in 1932 at Walton-on-Thames in Surrey. My father was a solicitor in London. I lived at Walton-on-Thames until he died in 1949, and I was about to start articles with his firm. I was due to become a solicitor, but I, at that stage, decided to do my national service instead. Mm.
What date in 1932 was that?
13th of September.
And where did your parents send you to school?
I went to a school called Kimbolton in Huntingdonshire until I was about 11, and then I was ill for a year, and because of the distance involved, I then went to Cranley in Surrey.
Had your family had any background in the city? Had your grandparents?
No, although the answer is no. Although when I joined the Stock Exchange in 1952, there was a firm called Henry Burks & Sons. My father was a Henry Burks, which is a bit of a coincidence. But although I think there is a family connection there, it is very distant.
Mm. Now, how was it that you came to be working?
When I came out of the army, my father having died, there was no prospect of my existing as an article clerk for 5 years without pay, as the situation was in those days. That I needed to get a job, and I got a job in the city with Zoot and Gorton, as they were called.
How did you get the job?
I can't remember. I think it was through, it may have been through the Public Schools Appointments Bureau. I think that's what it was.
And how did your career with De Zoot?
I started in the general office in De Zoot and Gorton, and I spent a year there keeping a gilt-edged jobber's ledger. Then I went into their private client department, answering the phone to banks and private clients. Then I spent about a year in De Zoot's private client department doing valuations and reports. Then I went and spent about another year to 18 months in their gilt-edged back room, as they called it, which was a room up in the office, in the main office. De Zoot's gilt-edged partners all operated from a box in the Stock Exchange. And I spent my day in this room working out redemption yields and preparing lists of yields which went out to clients. Then I went into the house as a blue button with De Zoot and Gorton. Mm. And I suppose I was in the house about a year with them. And a job was advertised in the Financial Times for a blue button, which in those days was a rather princely salary of £600, and I applied and in fact got the job.
And who was that with?
With Phillips and Drew.
When was that?
I joined Phillips and Drew in September 1957.
Mm. Before we leave De Zoot, what kind of broking firm were they? Where did they fit in the hierarchy of
They were a very long established firm of stockbrokers. I would say large to middle size, or middle to large size, with a speciality in tea and rubber, which Sir Martin Wilkinson, who subsequently became chairman of the Stock Exchange, he and his father before him had operated in the tea and rubber market, and in much earlier years, of course, they'd been quite large areas of the market. But they covered the waterfront, and they had a very good business. They were rather old-fashioned in those days in relation or by comparison to Phillips and Drew. I mean, when I joined Phillips and Drew, it was a completely different atmosphere and setup. In De Zoot's, unless you were a partner, you weren't normally expected to speak to clients to any great extent in those days. Whereas in Phillips and Drew, responsibility was heaped on you at a very early age. When I joined Phillips and Drew, there were probably only 100 people in the firm altogether. Mm. There were only about 10 partners. And we had quite small offices in Pinner's Hall. By the time I retired, there were 72 partners and very nearly 1,000 staff.
Mm. And were they already at that stage specialising in gilts?
Yes, they. Each department in Phillips and Drew was relatively small. I suppose that there were three partners on the gilt edge desk with perhaps three assistants and a similar number operating in the equity market. Mm. But already Phillips and Drew were building up a reputation for research, both in the gilt edge market and in the equity market. And their whole reputation had been founded on professional people, either actuaries, chartered accountants, or people of that caliber. I had no qualifications, I might say, for the in that line for the role I carried out, but I had, I have to say, a good training and a good groundwork in De Zoet, because I covered so many had training in so many different aspects of the business, which stood me in very good stead.
Do you have any early memories of going onto the floor of the house as a blue button with De Zoet? Which markets were you?
I was a general blue button with De Zoet in the equity market. I don't, other than that it was in the old stock exchange, I don't think I had any specialist role in as a blue button in those days.
What was your job then? Were you collecting prices?
Yes, yes. I would say that also in De Zoet, in my early days, as well as keeping this gilt-edged jobber's ledger, I did the checking, which in those days involved going down underneath the stock exchange and checking the bargains that had been done the day before. And one was a red button then, and then one became a blue button on the floor of the house. Now I was a general blue button for De Zoet. When I joined Phillips and Drew, I joined as a blue button. Phillips and Drew had a very small house staff. They had one partner and two dealers, and I think two blue buttons when I joined. And the partner dealt in the gilt edge market, and the two dealers dealt in the equity market. And they were very understaffed. And coincidentally, with my being taken on as a blue button, a man called Paul Bazalgette joined Phillips and Drew as a senior dealer and in the equity market, because Phillips and Drew realised that they, with the expansion of their building business, they didn't really have sufficient skill or numbers of people in the house on the dealing side. And Paul Bazalgette joined Phillips and Drew on the equity side, as I joined them on the equity side in September 1957, and within 2 or 3 years he became a partner, and he was taken on with the prospect of becoming a partner, and he was a very well-known and very respected dealer on the floor of the stock exchange in the equity market. I spent I would think it would be 2 years on the equity side of Phillips and Drew, and then I was asked if I would go on to the fixed interest side and joined a man called Arthur Beard, who was the partner in the house, as his assistant. So I did that, and in the early days, he dealt in gilt edge stocks, and for no particular reason, as well as debentures and preference shares, and for no particular reason, also dealt in banks, hard purchase, and insurance shares. Those three categories were not dealt in by the equity dealers. And so I became his assistant, and I think in a short time I was authorized as a dealer. And his wife was seriously ill for many years, and he wished to retire early, and in fact retired I think in 1962. And I then became, rather luckily perhaps, the senior gilt edge dealer for Phillips and Drew in 1963, and was made a partner in Phillips and Drew in 1963. Mm. I would have been 31.
Was that relatively young for becoming a partner?
I think, let's say I was lucky to be a partner at that age, I think, in that role. And so I was very much, although I held a senior position in the gilt edge market, in terms that I was the senior gilt edge dealer for Phillips and Drew, and we were a firm with an expanding business in the gilt edge market, I was very much younger than the other comparable dealers in other firms, for instance, Mullins, Pembers, Grievesons, Dezoots. They were all men in their 50s. I think that the hierarchy in the stock exchange then was older than it is today. You didn't aspire to seniority, or the partners tended to go on to an older age anyway. And all those senior dealers, as I say, were in their 50s, and I was barely 30. So I was very much the boy in an older man's world.
Did you feel that placed you at a disadvantage in any way?
I think in some ways it was worked to my advantage, because I was a bit, in a sense, a bit different because of my age. It may have allowed me to get away with a bit more than I might otherwise have been able to. I formed, over the years, a very close friendship in business terms with the partners of Wedd and Aykroyd particularly, and a firm called Wilson and Watford. Phillips and Drew always had a very close relationship with Wilson and Watford. Arthur Beard had been a great friend of Herbert Wilson, who was a very, very good small jobber. And I think Wilson and Watford probably ran almost equal third to Francis and Praed after Wedd and Aykroyd. And Wedd were amazed when they discovered the extent of our business with Wilson Watford, as they did. They never realized that Phillips and Drew had the size of business until I started dealing with them. They had been unaware that we had this size of business, because a lot of it had been done with Wilson and Watford, in fact.
Why were they amazed that you were doing a lot of business with Wilson and Watford?
Arthur Beard, who I had great respect and who was a marvellous mentor of mine, at one stage had a bit of a row with Dick Wilkins, and I don't think they ever quite got on. So that we didn't do as much business as we might have done with Wedd. Aykroyd, the senior partner there was Hugh Merriman, and I was a contemporary of Brian Pepiat and Tim Nixon, who were the same age as myself. The partners on Wedd's book were all of the Wilkins era, in that Wilkins, Priestley, Dick Russell were all of a similar age. And then in those days, John Robertson was on the book, and he was my age. He was a bit younger than me. But he didn't remain on the long book for many years after I became the dealing partner of Phillips and Drew. So most of my dealing was with Wilkins Priestley, Merriman, Pepiat, Nixon. With Wilson Watford, Herbert Wilson, and his son Nigel Wilson. And we had quite considerably less dealings with Francis and Prain. We did a certain amount of business with Bruce and Hinton, and then most of the other firms were smaller, and we didn't have institutional business of a size that we could transact with them. We did a certain amount with Campion and Paul, but that was not a great amount to a great deal.
Would you say you learnt most of your dealing skills from Arthur Beard?
Yes. He was a very, very respected man. He was a bit, could be very fearsome. But he was very shrewd. And yes, I certainly learnt a lot from him.
Is it possible to identify certain qualities that one needed to be a good dealer?
I always felt that the first thing, most important thing, is not to be hypnotized by a price. The price is only a figment of anybody's imagination at any particular time. Because they were calling a stock a certain price, didn't mean to say that in the end you needed to deal within that price. A lot of people felt that that was the price and that was all they were going to get. And in many ways, by asking a jobber, you gave him the price was, you gave him the initiative, because he said what his price was. And then I think a broker's role was to know the price or know what to expect the price to be. If the market was falling, the right price might have been quite a bit below what they were actually calling them. And therefore, if you were a buyer, there was no reason to feel that you had to deal within the price they were quoting. You might well finish it up getting it cheaper than that. And so I always felt that if you asked a jobber a price, you might well hear something you didn't really want to hear. And it was far more important in my book to know what the situation of jobbers' books were in the market. Both as a whole and in individual stocks. And you only gleaned this by experience and being trusted by them. So that if you got an order, very often the way to do it was to say, I'll give you so much for such and such a thing, and forget what they were calling them. Because if it was if you were a buyer and they wanted to sell stock, okay, they weren't going to, they couldn't put the price up against you because they were your way. If, on the other hand, you were a buyer and they were short of stock, well, then that is a different situation entirely, and you have to be careful and you have to obviously ask the price and pin them down on what they were calling the stock. But if you were doing what they wanted to do, that is buying stock when they wanted to sell it, then there was much more scope for stating what your price was.
So you'd in effect go and bid them?
Yes. But again, there were ways of doing it, and I can't say that you would necessarily often do it, but there was a great advantage to having a shrewd idea what the situation was in the market. And a lot of brokers, I don't think, applied themselves to knowing that as much as they might have done.
Can you recall any particular examples? Were there jobbers who didn't like being dealt with in that way?
Well, there were some jobbers that you wouldn't naturally be able to do that because you didn't necessarily have the relationship with them, or it was because of the aspect of a lot of Phillips and Drew's business that we obtained quite a lot of business with a view to undoing the jobbers' positions, and they were therefore very often prepared to tell us which way they were in certain stocks, because they could rely on us to some extent being able to undo their positions. There were obviously times when we obtained business which were against the way the market was, and they accepted that, and there were a few occasions when they led me to believe that they had a position in perhaps less stock than they did have, and that could lead to a few ructions on occasions. I well remember a case when Dick Wilkins said they'd got 5 million funding fours, and after a lot of trouble we found a buyer for 5 million funding fours. Then I discovered they'd actually got 15 million of them, which didn't please me very much. But
can you elaborate a bit on that side of Phillips and Drew's business you mentioned earlier? Being able to undo the job.
Well, we had a number of insurance companies. Some of them who adopted quite an active switching policy, and therefore they would exchange stocks one for another with the prospect of making quite a small profit, reversing the switch for quite a small profit. Now, most gilt-edged switches, the client would not open the switch unless he was could be reasonably sure of getting at least 0.5% net of expenses. So after having paid our commission and reversing the switch, he would want to get back into his original profit, position, having made 0.5%. If one of the larger jobbers had done, say, he had bought a large line of a certain stock, now he would have already obtained that stock at a price below the market price, because one of the larger jobbers would have naturally made a price in any gilt-edged stock in, say, 0.5 million. But if the broker said, right, I want a price in 2.5 million, then he would have widened his price, so the jobber would have obtained the stock on some occasions quite considerably cheaper. Now, if we bought that stock at something near that margin cheaper, already there was the prospect of a profit in a switch transaction. And so we did these switches for a number of clients with the prospect of that client making quite a small profit. But because the clients were prepared to be active, we did a vast amount of business on this basis. Because from when I joined the stock exchange in 1952, and I can remember around that time, Borlone was about 95, and at one stage, I think during my lifetime in the stock exchange, Borlone got down to about 17. So all those, over all that period, the gilt-edged market had gradually fallen. It had little blips about twice a year. It would go up. And but by and large, we were in a falling market throughout that most of that time. And it was quite a factor that this was happening.
Would you say switching was one of the most important parts of a broker's business?
It was very important in Phillips and Drew. There were other firms, for instance, Mullins and Pembers. Pembers had large clearing bank business, but they Mullins and Pembers and a number of others tended to get large straight orders on occasions, and very often these were sales of gilt-edged stock, because over the years the insurance companies and pension funds built up their equity portfolios and ran down their gilt edge portfolios. So there was a steady stream of stock coming onto the market. And we, as I say, did this switching business. Because the jobber, perhaps rather than having all his eggs in, if he'd bought 5 million of a particular stock, he would have rather had a number of stocks than having all his eggs in one basket. So we would sell him three other stocks and buy part of the 5 million for the one.
And by and large, was it were different institutions, different clients and different jobbers wanting to switch different stocks, or was it ever the case that they all wanted to do the same switch because there was the same basic?
There were times when, for one reason or another, in those days, some gilt-edged stocks had factors that affected them as individual stocks. They couldn't be regarded as just part of the gilt-edged market as a whole that moved up and down. But there was always a price. There is always a price for everything, and you will always find a buyer of any stock or a seller of any stock if the price is attractive. In as market as it was in those days, as big as the gilt-edge market, because there was plenty of stock in issue. And whereas people over the years have tried to create shortages in some gilt-edge stock, they very nearly always came undone, because there was always somebody with some stock which would resolve the situation. And there were people who thought that they could drive up the price of some stock like Conversion 3.5s, irredeemable, because of a sinking fund, and Old Consols that was the subject of a strong buying at one stage, because the gentleman concerned thought he could create a shortage. But in the end, they tended to fail because somebody would sell the stock and resolve the situation.
What was the object of creating a shortage? Was it to kind of corner the market?
Yes, to drive the price up.
Now, you'd originally had your blue button experience in the equity market. Was the gilt market a very different kind of place?
Yes, it's a much smaller market. You're dealing with the same people, or a limited number of people. In my case, most of the business was done with two firms and a certain amount with Wilson and Watford. So one had to retain the trust and confidence of those two major firms of jobbers. It would have obviously been unacceptable for Phillips and Drew for me to have made myself so unpopular with one of those, or either or both of those firms, so that we couldn't transact our business. Happily, I never got anywhere near that situation, so I didn't have that problem.
Did you still find it a competitive market, even though
Highly competitive.
You had a choice?
Highly competitive, yes.
How did that manifest itself?
You only have to have two people in any game for it to be competitive. When I started in the gilt edge market, I think there were 26 firms of jobbers. How there was enough business for them all, I don't know. But in the end, it came down to really just two jobbers. And provided you have got two, you have got competition. And that is all that's necessary, really.
What was your impression of the relationship between the two jobbing firms? I mean, towards the end, the jobbers, in a sense, became very close because there were so few of them.
I think that the two major firms always had a fairly good working relationship. There was always competition between them, but I think that they were respectful friends. They were highly, very competitive with one another, but I think that they could be sociable after hours, and there wasn't a problem.
Did you ever find yourself wishing for a third firm to go and deal with?
Well, we always, I felt, had a third firm in the shape of Wilson and Watford. And because of a close relationship with them. They did a really quite large amount of our business at times. And then there were other firms. There was Francis and Praed, and one or two others who on occasions would have a fling and do a certain amount.
How would you decide to go to these other firms? Would it be on the prices they were quoting? Or the particular size you wanted?
It was a feature of the gilt-edge market that, unlike the equity market, you couldn't, or it was unwise to go round the market and check the price and then go back to one of the jobbers. If you went back, he and the jobber knew you'd been elsewhere and checked the market. In the gilt-edge market, more than the equity market, they knew that you'd checked the market. The only reason you were going back to them was that they were making the best price in relation to you. If you did this on a regular basis, you were, had less likelihood of doing your business than if you just approached them direct. It was, and this goes back to what I regarded as the role of the broker. It was for him to know the price without asking it. If you know what the price is, then you don't need to go and ask anybody else. And you're far more likely to do a good deal